Lecture 46, Alexander as King.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello again. How great was Alexander as a king? He won some spectacular military battles in Asia, as we saw in the last lecture. However, he wasn't just a general, he was a king. And being general was only part of the package of king. In this lecture, we're going to look at his disturbing behavior and the sides to his character as he marched further eastwards that must affect our appreciation of him as a king, and hence by extension affect our evaluation of whether he should still be called great. As examples, I want to discuss two conspiracies against Alexander, one involving Philotas, the commander of the companion cavalry, and the other involving some of the royal pages who were attendants of the king. Alexander seems to have exploited both of these conspiracies to rid himself of vocal opponents. I also want to discuss his drunken murder of a senior general called Clitus. And finally, I want to examine the view that he was an idealist who wanted to use his power as king to unite the races. I'll discuss Alexander's pretensions to personal divinity in our next lecture, which deals with him as a man, although obviously a belief in his own divinity affects his kingship as well. Now, in 330 at Phrada in Bactria, a soldier called Dymnus apparently plotted to kill Alexander. When Dymnus tried to recruit another man called Cebolinus in the conspiracy, Cebolinus told Philotas, the commander of the companion cavalry, about it. Now, Cebolinus didn't have the authority to visit Alexander himself, and so he wanted Philotas to tell the king what was going on. For some reason, Philotas decided against telling Alexander. So finally, Cebolinus got one of the royal pages, these were young lads who attended the king, to smuggle him into the royal tent where he told Alexander about the plot. The king immediately ordered an investigation, which led to the arrest of Demetrius, one of the royal bodyguards, and Philotas. In the meantime, Dymnus committed suicide. The following day, Philotas was put on trial for treason before an assembly of 6,000 soldiers. Now remember that when the king was on campaign, the assembly travelled with him, so to speak, as it would be composed exclusively of soldiers. And the assembly also judged cases of treason. Now Alexander accused Philotas of treason now. And other generals who disliked Philotas personally weighed in against him as well. Philotas said that he hadn't told Alexander about the conspiracy because he believed that there was no such thing and he didn't want to bother Alexander about it. But Philotas was doomed, and Alexander even scolded him for delivering his defense in Greek and not in Macedonian. Philotas was found guilty, and he was executed by javelin. Then Alexander gave orders for the execution of Philotas's father, the veteran general Parmenion. Now at this time, Parmenion was in Ecbatana, the modern Hamadan. He was in command of 6,200 Macedonians and 5,600 Greek mercenaries. Parmenion was completely oblivious of what was happening in Alexander's camp in Phrada. A letter came from Alexander addressed to one of the other generals at Ecbatana, ordering him to kill Parmenion, and he did the deed at once. Another letter was then read out to Parmenion's troops to ensure their loyalty to Alexander. Now there's no question that Philotas was in the wrong for not having informed Alexander about a plot, no matter how imaginary that he thought it was. However, Philotas wasn't part of it. If he were, Cebolinus would hardly have opened up to him about it and urged him to warn the king. And if Philotas happened to be part of the conspiracy, it's very hard to understand why he allowed Cibollinus to live when he was set on telling Alexander about it. Philotas then had nothing to do with any plot, and it would have been enough for Alexander to punish him some other way, perhaps a demotion. But the trial and condemnation for treason on Alexander's orders are extreme. And even more so is the killing of Parmenion, who was not in Phrada at the time and didn't know anything of what was going on. What lies at the heart of the Philotas conspiracy, as modern historians call it, is Alexander ridding himself of critics. Philotas had defied Alexander on more than one occasion about the need to continue marching eastwards, and he'd also criticized the king's growing Orientalism. By that I mean Alexander's adoption of Persian dress, of Asian customs, and perhaps even the belief in his own divine status. Once again, we see Alexander as king acting for personal reasons. Once someone crossed him, there was no redemption. It's a pattern that started with the Thebans in their revolt of 335, and it's not going to get any better. Then there's Parmenion. Parmenion was one of the old guard generals who had served under Philip, and he also was none too happy with the way Alexander was changing. Parmenion was also very powerful and well respected, which is probably why Alexander felt the need to send a letter to Parmenion's troops at Ecbatana in case they rebelled when Parmenion was killed. Now, under Macedonian law, a traitor's family could also be put to death, so Alexander did have right on his side. And he may have felt that he had no choice because of Parmenion's influence and the loyalty that the army had for him. I mean, after all, Parmenion would not have taken the trial and execution of his son Philotas lying down, so Alexander had to get rid of him. But aside from this, Alexander again had a personal reason in wanting to do away with Parmenion. And it was this, more than anything else, that caused him to move against this trusted and proved general. Relations between Parmenion and Alexander had been strained for some years. In 334, Alexander had disregarded Parmenion's advice before the Battle of the Granicus River. Well, that was a minor thing, and Alexander as king was perfectly within his rights to overrule his generals. But it started a pattern that was perhaps as much Parmenion's fault in many respects as it was Alexander's, because Parmenion was probably not used to being bossed around by someone in his early 20s. A major disagreement between the two men was at Tyre in late 331. Darius had sent Alexander a letter offering to surrender all territories west of the Euphrates River, to become the friend and ally of Alexander, and to pay 30,000 talents for the return of his family, whom Alexander had captured following the Battle of Issus in 333. Now, Parmenion thought this offer was too good to refuse, and he is alleged to have said that if he were Alexander, he would accept the terms. Alexander replied that if he were Parmenion, he probably would, meaning he wasn't going to accept them. Now, this exchange indicates that Parmenion thought the invasion had achieved its objective. Indeed, I couple this exchange with the extent to which Philip intended to go in Asia. Parmenion would have known about this. That's why I've said on more than one occasion that Philip probably intended to operate only in Asia Minor, and hence, when Darius made Alexander this offer, he may well have been talking about lands that Philip intended to campaign in, and Parmenion would have known that. Anyway, again, we have a clash between Parmenion and Alexander over policy. Then during the Battle of Gaugamela in 331, Parmenion was hard-pressed on the left flank and sent urgently to Alexander for help. The king either didn't get the message immediately, or he did and decided he wasn't going to act on it. Either way, no help came, but Parmenion was able to save the flank by the skin of his teeth. Perhaps we cannot discount that Alexander deliberately left Parmenion to his fate. The declining relations had led Alexander to isolate Parmenion from his court. That's why he sent him to Ecbatana. Now, the official reason was for Parmenion to oversee Macedonian control of Media and the safety of the great bullion train. But after that, there were no plans in place for Parmenion to rejoin Alexander. And the Philotas conspiracy gave Alexander the chance he may have wanted, the chance to remove Parmenion permanently. It's even possible that Alexander used Philotas as a pawn, that in other words, Alexander wanted to get rid of Parmenion and exploited the law about executing a traitor's family by involving Philotas in this plot. Now, I've made a meal out of what happened to Philotas and Parmenion because their fate gives us a disturbing insight into Alexander's growing paranoia and his inability to handle criticism. Now, if that's not bad enough, the removal of Philotas and Parmenion was at a critical time in the campaign in Bactria and Sogdiana, when Alexander needed all of the experienced soldiers that he could get. The army was far from home, the Macedonians were faced by intense guerrilla warfare in these satrapies, and Bessus was still on the loose as Artaxerxes V. In the summer of 328 at Marakanda, Samarkand, a drinking party got out of hand when Alexander and Clitus the Black, one of his senior generals, the man who'd saved Alexander's life at Granicus, got into a bitter argument. This was in reaction to flatterers at the party trying to outdo each other in their praise of Alexander, but at the expense of Philip. Clitus was also one of the old guard of Philip's generals, like Parmenion, and he wasn't going to let anyone trash Philip, and quite right too. Now, when Alexander said that it was he, Alexander, who'd been responsible for the victory at the Battle of Chaeronea, Clitus saw red, and he tore verbal strips off Alexander, ending with the comment that if it hadn't been for Clitus's actions at Granicus, Alexander would be dead by now. Now, everyone present was very drunk, especially Alexander, and so he attacked Clitus. Now, Ptolemy, one of Alexander's boyhood friends and the founder of the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt, Ptolemy managed to bundle Clitus out of the banqueting hall, so he separated the two men. But as things calmed down, Clitus bounded back in, taunting Alexander further. Perhaps Clitus's taunts brought back memories of Attalus's taunt at Philip's 7th wedding banquet. Whatever, Alexander grabbed a pike off one of his bodyguards and ran it through Clitus, killing him on the spot. Now, there was no conspiracy here involving Clitus. There was nothing to indicate that Alexander thought he was about to be assassinated. For one thing, Clitus was unarmed. Only the king's personal bodyguard was allowed to bear arms at symposia, at drinking parties. Now, while it's certainly true that Clitus should not have talked to his king the way he did, it's impossible to excuse Alexander's action. His reason gave way to emotion, which is not a sign of a great king. Again, though, Clitus was being isolated from the court because Alexander had chosen him to be the new satrap of Bactria. This was an important position, but it was one that meant that Clitus would stay where he was while Alexander moved on. And so another member of the old guard and a critic of Alexander's Asian plans and Orientalism bit the dust. We're told, by the way, that Alexander regretted what he'd done to Clitus, but that this was more because Clitus was unarmed. In other words, in attacking and in killing an unarmed man, Alexander hadn't acted in the fashion of a Homeric hero, one on which he modelled himself. Now, the reason for his regret says a lot about him as a man and as a king, doesn't it? For some reason, in Oliver Stone's Alexander movie of 2004, and honestly, I've tried not to bring that up, but I can't help it now. The Clitus episode is set in India. But that's only one of many historical inaccuracies in that movie. Equally startling ones are Alexander almost getting killed at Granicus being transferred to Gaugamela. Alexander also almost dies at the Hydaspes. And then there's a conflation of the two mutinies at the Hephaestus River and at Opis into one. And poor old Philotas is part of the Pages conspiracy, which I'll deal with in a moment, but which took place 3 years after Philotas was executed. And in the very first scene of the movie, we have Ptolemy I, played by Anthony Hopkins, shuffling out onto his porch, looking out over the harbour of Alexandria, and there's the lighthouse in the distance. Uh-oh, the lighthouse wasn't built till the reign of his son. Don't get me talking about that movie, really. Let's move on. A short while later, in Bactra in 327, another conspiracy against Alexander was discovered. This time it involved the royal pages. Now, while on a hunt, Alexander was poised to kill a boar when one of the boys, a lad called Hermolaus, in youthful exuberance, killed it instead. For this, Hermolaus was publicly caned and his horse was confiscated. Now, again, Hermolaus was actually in the wrong. The right to kill was the king's, so Hermolaus sort of usurped Alexander's kill here, and so it was also right for Hermolaus to be punished. Nevertheless, he wanted revenge. And he apparently persuaded three other pages to join him in killing Alexander while the king slept one night. Since the pages stood guard over the king in his bedroom while he slept, the conspiracy had a very good chance of succeeding. Now, Alexander foiled the plot because, according to some sources, he stayed up all night drinking and never made it to bed. This is an instance when alcohol can save lives. Eventually, however, details of the conspiracy came out and these young pages were arrested. So also was the court historian and Aristotle's nephew, Callisthenes. And Callisthenes was responsible for the pages' education at court. Now, the pages were tortured and eventually stoned to death. But at no point did they say that Callisthenes was involved in any plot. Nevertheless, Alexander had him executed as a traitor. Now, the pages' conspiracy is a very odd affair. For one thing, I can understand Hermolaus wanting to get his own back, even though technically he was in the wrong. But why would other pages who got nothing to do with this hunt, who had not suffered at Alexander's hands, would they want to help Hermolaus kill the king? What's more, if Alexander went to sleep one night with four pages in his bedroom, and the next morning he was found dead with the same four pages in the bedroom, it'd be pretty obvious who killed him. Perhaps the other pages had been abused in some way by Alexander, we just don't know. But what we do know is that Alexander was up to something by implicating Callisthenes in the plot. It's more than just paranoia on the king's part, and paranoia is now part of the pattern of a deteriorating man and a deteriorating reign. No matter how senior the critic, no matter where the army was in Asia, the days of anyone who crossed Alexander were numbered. So what had Callisthenes done? Well, I'll tell you. Earlier in Bactra, Alexander had attempted to introduce the Asian custom of proskynesis, or genuflection, at his court. Now, the Persian subjects of the great king prostrated themselves before him as a matter of course. But to the Greeks, this was blasphemy, as it was tantamount to worship of a living man. Even the posture was unacceptable, because Greeks commonly prayed standing up with their arms upraised, whereas only slaves lay on the ground. Now, this is assuming, by the way, that prostration was the person lying face down, flat on the ground. There is a belief that it might just have been a kneeling position. Anyway, it doesn't matter, because when Alexander tried to introduce this custom at his court among his own men, Callisthenes refused to perform it, and the other men then followed suit, which forced Alexander to abandon the attempt. Now, you can see where I'm going, can't you? Whether Callisthenes was implicated in the Pages conspiracy didn't matter in the big picture. The moment he defied Alexander, he was a dead man. All Alexander needed was a scenario to justify removing Callisthenes, and the Pages conspiracy gave him that. Perhaps we should not be surprised that Ephippus, who is a contemporary source, said that people living at Alexander's court did so in a reign of fear. Now, as king, Alexander insisted on spreading Greek civilization throughout Asia. And there's nothing wrong with exposing people to a different culture, of course. But Alexander made no attempt to recognize local customs when they contradicted what Greeks thought about them or that he personally disliked. A case in point is the Bactrian custom of killing their elderly or the infirm. A contemporary source says, and I'd like to quote now, quote, "Those who become infirm because of old age or sickness are thrown out alive as prey to dogs, which they keep specifically for this purpose. And in their native tongue, they're called undertakers. While the land outside the walls of the city of the Bactrians looks clean, most of the land inside the walls is full of human bones." That sounds a bit yucky, I know. Now, Alexander ended this custom because the Greeks considered it reprehensible. He'd got no business to do so when you think about it. But it was the sort of attitude, you know, we're Greeks, we know best, you have to do what we do. It's that attitude that caused discontent through all the places that Alexander marched, and it affected his kingship enormously. Now, one belief about Alexander that contributes to the image of him as a great king is that he was an idealist who strove to unite the races into one, who had a policy towards a unity of mankind. Now, this issue is important because it has a bearing on how we should consider the historical Alexander, the real Alexander. Now, several events in Alexander's reign have been seen as his desire to establish this brotherhood of mankind. These include his integration of foreigners into his army and administration, such as specialist troops from Iran. And it also includes the use of native satraps or rulers in the provinces, the satrapies of the Persian Empire. There's also his marriage in the spring of 327 to the Bactrian princess Roxanne. His attempt to adopt the Persian custom of proskynesis at his court. Then a mass wedding at Susa in 324, where Alexander and 91 members of his court married various Persian noble women. And then finally at Opis in 324, when he put down the mutiny there and he held this great reconciliation banquet, at which the sources say Macedonian, Greek and Persian sipped from the same cup, and Alexander prayed for harmony among everyone, harmony of the races. Well, none of these has any ideological purpose other than a pragmatic one. They're all pragmatic. For example, foreigners in his army were kept apart in their own ethnic units, and native satraps were merely titular figureheads. They were used as a link between their own people and himself. because control of the all-important military reserves and control of the treasury were always in the hands of Macedonians. You would expect foreigners in the army to be mixed up among existing regiments, not kept sort of banded together in their own ethnic units. Alexander was using these troops because of their specialist skills. As for the marriage to Roxanne, this was in the same vein as his father's political marriages, because Roxanne's father had been one of his recent opponents in Bactria. Marriage to the daughter now earned Alexander the support of her father, and with any luck, that might bring with it the passivity of Bactria. So Alexander is just taking a leaf out of his father's book here in marrying Roxanne for political reasons. He's not having this interracial marriage to show that he's trying to, you know, set a trend in any way of uniting the races. The proskynesis attempt that I talked about just before. This is very intriguing because it looks like Alexander was trying to fashion some sort of common social protocol between the different races. At the same time, he knew the Greeks thought the actual act of proskynesis was sacrilegious. As I said, they only worship gods or dead heroes. A more likely explanation, as we'll see in the next lecture, is that Alexander now thought of himself as divine, and proskynesis was meant for everyone to recognize this. While the symbolism of the interracial mass marriage at Susa might seem obvious, it's important to note that no Greek women were brought out from the mainland to marry Asian noble men. And we would expect this if Alexander was sincere about a fusion policy. What Alexander was doing was polluting the bloodline to ensure that children from these marriages would never have a claim to the Persian throne. And you know what? Even in Iran today, yes, today, the people can still remember this mass marriage at Susa, and they still criticize Alexander for it. They call him Alexander the Accursed. What a great example of ancient history coming alive today. Finally, the common banquet and the prayer to harmony after the Opis mutiny. We should note that at the reconciliation banquet, there was a conscious seating order to emphasize superiority. Macedonians sat next to Alexander, then Greeks, and then others. There was no mixing up of the people, as we would expect. Also, the prayer to future concord was about unity in the army, not unity of mankind. Alexander planned to invade Arabia next, and so dissension in the ranks was the last thing he wanted. Nevertheless, the legendary Alexander, exemplified as an attempted unifier of the races, still appears from time to time, in scholarship and in popular culture. More recently, it appeared in Stone's 2004 movie, which in effect is just another addition to the Alexander legend. Now, although the 1956 movie, directed by Robert Rosen and with Richard Burton as Alexander, has its flaws, at least it captures more of what made Alexander tick. And there's nothing in there to try to show that Alexander was trying to unite the races. The sorts of things that we've been talking about, and really they're only the tip of the iceberg, have to affect Alexander as a king, and especially whether we can blindly still call him great. But perhaps the best way to assess his greatness is by his legacy. Now, compared to what his father Philip left him, Alexander's legacy was woeful. He hadn't produced an heir when he died. Roxanne was still pregnant. Even though his generals kept urging him to do so, he disregarded that. On his deathbed, Alexander gave his signet ring to his second-in-command, Perdiccas. Now, this perhaps means that he wanted Perdiccas to be his successor. But the other generals so disliked Perdiccas that they had no intention of following him. As a result, with no clear successor, chaos ensued. as the generals carved up Alexander's empire among themselves when the king died. There followed 3 decades now of bloody civil war, during which Greece and Macedonia were battlegrounds among the successors, before the great kingdoms of the Hellenistic period, Syria, Egypt, Macedonia/Greece, appeared. To me, at any rate, Alexander's military victories or his actions as king do not outweigh his legacy or justify his greatness. And this is just as true when we consider Alexander the man, as we will do so in the next lecture. Thank you very much.